for all the hassles our latest snowstorm has brought, it's very good news for our water supply. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a new airline service to Missoula, and in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with analytics expert Dan Wagner about how big data has changed political campaigning. Montanans are still digging themselves out from heavy snowfall in the western half of the state. Many locations west of the Continental Divide are recording anywhere from a foot to over 2 feet of snow. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us it all bodes well for mountain snowpack.
Mid-afternoon in Helena, cars are cautiously driving down streets. Plows don't seem to be able to plow the roads fast enough. Brandy Pearson is leaving her job in the Capitol building a little early.
I have to pick up my kids from school. I didn't want them to have to walk home in the 3 or 4 blocks when it's freezing.
She climbs into her black GMC Yukon, which has been warming in the Capitol parking lot. Her specialty license plate reads Winter Wonderland.
Well, I do enjoy snowmobiling and cross-country skiing, but today like this when it makes it so hard to drive and everybody's getting stuck, no, I don't like it.
The National Weather Service in Great Falls says the weather system starting this past weekend could very well be the biggest snow event so far this season. Meteorologist Eric Gustafson.
It's over in Missoula. I think this is their snowiest February since 1936.
He says west of the Continental Divide has seen the brunt of the snow, but some areas east got hit too.
You know, 12, 13 inches in Helena is certainly probably their highest of the season.
He says that puts snowpack in a lot of the important basins in western Montana between 110 and 140% of average so far. Snow from this system should taper off by early Tuesday morning, but Gustafson says another system could be heading in for the weekend.
So this weekend and the second half of this week could end up, you know, pushing a lot of places to either to near to their records for a winter season, never mind, for this month.
Brian DeMoncos is a Bozeman-based water supply specialist with the National Resource Conservation Service. He studies things like snowpack, and he agrees this is an optimistic trend.
You know, it's not just this storm system. It's been the series of storms that we've had since late January.
He says he would like to see snowfall in some mountain basins a little further along than they are, but there is still some time.
Usually the snowpack peaks anywhere from mid-April to early to mid-May.
He says it is too soon to shift from worrying about getting too much snow to worrying about spring flooding. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Helena.
Missoula's 5 or so inches of snow pales in comparison to places like the southern Bitterroot Valley, which has received some 2 feet of snow in some places, but that doesn't mean it's not having an impact on Garden City drivers. Missoula Mayor John Engen says plow crews are doing the best they can under the circumstances.
We've got our crews out, particularly, you know, when the weather's bad, we just go all out. So we're on our priorities all day long. And as snow begins to let up, we start reaching out into those neighborhoods. That tends to be a struggle for folks. They wish their neighborhood streets were plowed, but, you know, we would kill people with the tax bill if we were hitting every one of those as quickly as we'd like. So we're doing our best.
Engen urges Missoulians to be patient and says those city plows will get into the neighborhoods just as soon as they can.
And in other news from around the state, Frontier Airlines will offer direct flights between Denver and Missoula beginning June 13th. The Denver-based airline will offer service from Missoula to Denver on Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. It will offer service from Denver to Missoula on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. The deal was in the works since 2008, and today's announcement was welcomed by local civic and business leaders. Frontier's Senior Director of Planning and Scheduling, Bob Westgate, describes Missoula as a great destination for many of the airline's customers. Westgate adds Frontier's new direct-to-Denver service will offer plenty to Missoulians as well.
Looking at the airfares that people are currently have the misfortune of paying to get in and out of here, that certainly from an airfare perspective, it should stimulate traffic, and that would be very helpful for the airport as well as for economic development in the region. I know when I was looking at coming up here myself to be here today, I was a bit surprised to see that the airfare was about $1,000 for the round trip. I went back to our revenue management and pricing department and said, shared this information with them, and they were like, wow, that's really like going to London. Anyway, I said, what's the most we would probably charge someone? All in, all the taxes, the fees, and all the stuff. And he said, I can't imagine getting as much above $500 to do a round trip between Denver and Missoula. So based on that, I think that we'll offer, of course, the low fares, the value experience, and that should stimulate traffic and be a great thing for the community.
David Bell is president and CEO of ALPS Corporation, a Montana-based professional liability insurer. Bell says he thinks today's announcement could ultimately drive down Missoula's airfare rates, which are notoriously high.
If you look at the entrance of additional air carriers in other cities, on average, it's driven down rates 30%. And so, you know, time will tell what will happen in Missoula, but when you have a carrier that has a hub in Denver, which shares a hub with United, it seems reasonable to expect that you'll see pretty prompt reactions from the United fare structure, which will then cascade into reactions from the Delta fare structure. So whether you're a business traveler or a recreational traveler, this is just good news all around.
Missoula Mayor John Engen says he frequently meets with business owners who are interested in Missoula but put off by the town's limited and expensive air travel options.
In the fall, I was at an event, and a software executive from Silicon Valley wants out of Silicon Valley. It's very expensive. Lifestyle isn't what they'd like it to be. They like the opportunities in Missoula, and said to me directly, we're here if you can take care of the airfare thing. Right? And I think we hear that over and over again, and the partnership folks hear it over and over again. And airfare is a big deal.
Chris Jensen, director of Missoula International Airport, says the new service could help stop the leakage of passengers to other airports, including those in Bozeman and Spokane. He says about 30,000 people who live near the Missoula airport choose other airports each year.
The U.S. Supreme Court has again declined to review a Montana law that exempts guns made and kept in the state from federal regulation. Today, the High Court denied a petition from Montana Attorney General Tim Fox to review prior court rulings against the state law. Justices in January rejected a related petition from Gary Marbit with the Montana Shooting Sports Association. Montana's legislature passed a law in 2009 that says firearms that remain in the state where they were manufactured are not subject to Congress's authority to regulate interstate commerce. At least 8 other states have passed similar laws. Marbit says the issue could be revived if a plaintiff files a lawsuit in one of those states.
About 4,000 acres north of Helena have been surveyed in an effort to remove unexploded ordnance remaining from live fire exercises that ended in the area nearly 60 years ago. Cindy West, manager of the Montana Army National Guard Unexploded Ordnance Program, says 160 unexploded projectiles have been removed from the area in the North Helena Valley, and cleanup of the nearly 5,000-acre site is expected to be completed in 2017. The Helena Independent Record reports the unexploded ordnance date from 1947, when the Army National Guard was reconstituted and told to negotiate with landowners for live fire practice areas because there was no land large enough for artillery at Fort Harrison. West says the 163rd Regimental Combat Team used landowners' properties north of Helena until 1955.
The University of Montana Law School today received the largest gift in the school's history from alum and prominent Great Falls attorney Xander Blewett III. Blewett and his wife Andy gave the school $800,000 to be used for 3 scholarships to help Montana State University graduates attend the law school.
We've found over the time that one of the big needs of the law school are scholarships, because even though we are the bargain legal education probably in the United States, even though the tuition is low, we are having students weaned away or wooed away because of scholarships. Even though their tuition might be 3 times what ours is, they are getting the better students because of these big scholarships, and we hope to put an end to that, at least partially.
Blewett's father and 2 sons are also graduates of the UM Law School. He and his wife are longtime donors to both MSU and UM.
It's nice to be able to instill a little Bobcat blood into Grizz Nation.
The first Blewett scholars will be announced in the fall.
He's been called a cross between Bill Gates and Batman. As the chief analytics officer for the 2012 Obama campaign, Dan Wagner and his staff of data scientists revolutionized how big data is used to target voters and get them to the polls. Wagner is now CEO of the big data analytics firm Civis Analytics and is in Missoula to lecture on the impact of big data on electoral politics. In this feature interview, Wagner talks with news director Sally Mock about what set the 2012 campaign apart, both in what data was collected and how it was used to re-elect the president.
Number one is that, you know, the primary source of information that all campaigns use is the voter file. So you go to the Secretary of State or the DMV even, and you register to vote, and you put your information on a little piece of paper. That little piece of paper gets carried to the County Board of Elections, which gets carried over to the State Secretary of State or the Board of Elections, and it gets put into this big list. And campaigns for many years, essentially going back to Abraham Lincoln, have been using those list of people to figure out who might be undecided and who might be the type of people that we should turn out to get them to vote. So in a lot of ways, campaigning hasn't really changed since the 1860s. We need to register new people to get them to vote for us. We need to turn out our likely supporters, and we need to persuade people. What's changed is how we use that information to do it better. So what kind of inferences that we're building on top of those lists to do it better, and how we're adding new pieces of information from outside the voter file and adding it to that to enhance our ability to build those inferences. For example, digital information, fundraising information, to a limited extent, consumer data, though it's not that important. And kind of putting that into a single unified database from which we can analyze all those points of data to help understand who do we persuade, who we turn out, and who do we register.
And what you did that was different this time, as I understand it, was you really individualized that information. You didn't just say women under 40
That's right.
may support President Obama versus women over 60. You were much more individual, correct?
Yeah, that was one of the kind of the main principles that we took into 2012. For many years, campaigns, and if you listen to television pundits, you'll sometimes hear them using some of these words. They'll say, the key is women, or they need to turn out Hispanics, or
as a class
of people. And there's an underlying assumption within that language that those people are, in fact, the same. But when you start to look at some of these data points on the voter file or even just in a basic survey, you start to understand kind of the diversity in our country is more than is stated through some of these conversations about people that are bucketed into these broad classifications or frankly stereotypes. And so when we thought about the campaign and we thought about what kind of outreach we were going to create for people, we thought about how we were making sure that we were turning out the right people, persuading the right people, registering the right people, but from a perspective that took into account the implicit diversity that is present all around our country. Or in a state, you know, like Montana. Not everybody in Montana is the same. They're very different from Missoula to Bozeman, and they're very different within Missoula from one side of the city to the other and from one house to the other. And the idea was how we individualized our outreach, taking into account everything we know about people, and then modifying our communication based on what they said back to us.
Here's what one reporter said about what you did, quote, "The campaign didn't just know who you were. It knew exactly how it could turn you into the type of person it wanted you to be."
With some likelihood, yeah. You know, we don't know everything about everybody all the time, but we were able to say the important things with a certain amount of certainty that helped the campaign design its outreach. So, for example, and one of the biggest assets the campaign had was the legacy infrastructure that's been built at the DNC, or the Democratic Party, for many years. And in Montana, I remember going back in the 2008 campaign and later in some of the midterm campaigns in 2010 and later in 2012, was that, you know, you guys have a very strong local campaign presence where a lot of people are very civically active in campaigns. And the record of the communication is actually recorded and then kept at the DNC. And that because it's recorded is that the next time we talk to you in 2014 or 2016, we can say, hey, you know, we talked to you in 2012. We know that you are undecided on these certain issues, and this is what was important to you. So because we have a more comprehensive picture of voters, because of those records of conversation, we're able to, you know, predict with a higher likelihood what might be important to people and customize our outreach based on that information.
And outreach is key too, isn't it? I think that sometimes gets lost in this discussion of big data. You have an idea that someone's sitting at a computer looking at all this information, but that is translated into what is really individual personal contact.
Yeah. Yeah. The rubber has to hit the road and work. You know, it's one thing to have a bunch of, you know, nerds sitting in a cave processing information on computers.
And it was called the cave, wasn't it?
It was called the cave, yeah. But that contribution is hollow unless there's a means of execution where personalization is present. And, you know, we invested a huge amount of our resources and probably larger than any campaign had done in history at a national level in this field, in the field, which is person-to-person, doors, phones, people talking to people with basic organizing and enabling those volunteers to have these personalized conversations. The analytics helped them conduct more accurately. But ultimately, you know, the only reason it was valuable was because those people built that infrastructure to make it possible.
A critic might say that this is still a little big brotherish, mm-hmm. and that you are basically framing a message to try to be all things to all people,
yeah.
versus having a message that a candidate strongly believes in,
yeah.
and you find the people who that message appeals to.
Yeah, and I think in terms of that difference between, you know, the big message that we use to communicate the campaign and then the specific message that we use to communicate to voters, I guess there's two points on that. Is number one is the main message that we used into the campaign was consistently used across voters. And that message had a lot to do with, you know, our country is going through an interesting process where middle class opportunity has shrunk. We've seen, you know, drops in median wages. And so a lot of what the main message of the campaign was about was communicating to all voters about that idea, about how we create an economy that was, you know, quote, built to last. And that message really permeated everything, both because that was the president's choice, but that also kind of matched the policy decisions that he had. So in that respect, it wasn't a pure analytical process that was driving that communication. It was really reflective of what the president himself wanted to talk about. But there are different people who think about different services from the government, from their country, that they want to hear about. For example, there are a lot of people I don't know, we actually had a campaign in New Hampshire where people were very interested in hearing about forestry policies. And they want to hear about the main message of the campaign, but they're also interested in hearing about how the federal government affects their lives. And as a result of that, we were able to customize something because that was something that was relevant to their life. They are less interested in hearing about, you know, import-export policies with NAFTA, for example. Some of them might be interested in TARP, but as a way to customize something to say, look, this is how we're interacting with your life based on what we think we know.
You really applied the old slogan, all politics is local.
Yeah, I think that is the idea, is that for many years you had these kind of two campaigns going at the same time. One, you had this big national campaign, which was hundreds of millions of dollars, placing these big bulk ads on TV saying positive, negative, et cetera, targeted towards those broad demographics. And then secondly is you had these very intimate local campaigns where neighbors knew their neighbors, they knew the issues that were important to them, and they talked about the issues that were pertinent to them because they had a record of history in their brains. The exercise was how we took that process B, which is the local campaign, and really scaled it up to build that same level of relevance at a national level. And the technology helped us facilitate that, but it was all, you know, it was about kind of building that organization and providing them with an infrastructure to help them do it. But, you know, our field team was ultimately the people who ended up doing it.
Well, your secret's out now.
Yeah, the concept of it is certainly out.
So it will be applied by all sides, I'm sure, in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the devil's in the details and execution. So, the story is kind of out there for better or for worse. If somebody wants to live in a 500 square foot closed off environment in the back of with 50 other people in the back room of a cave, I salute them. But I guess the point that I'll try and make is, you know, the curtain was opened up a little bit on the process. And that's okay. There are positives and negatives about that. You know, we were always maintained a policy in the campaign and previous to the campaign that we were building internally, and we never kind of spoke externally about it. Well, what I'll say is on a go-forward basis, you know, that was what we built in 2012, that the world is changing so quickly right now, and not just in campaigns, but in medicine, in education, in energy. And the race is going to be won by those people that are thinking about the future and are building capabilities that are consistent with that future. True for politics as much as it is for your local clinic down the street. When we think about what we're building, yeah, the curtain has opened up a little bit on the process. But I think at Civis, we're keeping our mind to within the politics and outside of politics, how we're building for the future and how we're thinking about making data more relevant for people.
One final question for you, Mr. Wagner. Any chance you're going to be working for Hillary in 2016?
We'll get there when we get there. Right now, our work in 2014, we are working with the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. So a lot of our work is very heavily focused on working with the Senate. And that's really what we're focused on now. And that's a long time away, so we'll get there when we get there.
You may be spending more time in Montana. It's a crucial race here.
Montana is a crucial race, yeah.
We have been speaking with Dan Wagner, who's CEO of Civis Analytics and also was the chief analytics officer for the 2012 Obama campaign, one of the key figures in how that campaign was conducted. Mr. Wagner, a pleasure to speak with you about the brave new world of analytics. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Dan Wagner will give a free public lecture on big data in electoral politics tonight at 7 o'clock in the Montana Theater on the University of Montana campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. The snow that has hit our listening area isn't ready to go away just yet. There are winter weather advisories in effect for most of our listening area tonight, so watch for snow and poor driving conditions. There are also winter storm warnings in effect overnight for Lewis and Clark County in the central Montana and Jefferson and Broadwater counties in southwest Montana. West of the Divide, there is also a wind chill advisory in effect from 8 p.m. this evening to 8 a.m. tomorrow for West Glacier region and the Flathead and Mission Valleys. Tonight, snow is likely with lows 4 to 11 degrees, and tomorrow, snow remains likely with highs in the 20s to lower 30s. For central Montana tonight, should be partially cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 5 below to 15 below zero. Tomorrow, expect sunny skies, highs 15 to 20 degrees. For southwest Montana, tonight should be cloudy with snow and lows 5 to 20 degrees, and tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with periods of snow through the day and highs in the 20s. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Northwestern Energy is proposing to purchase the Montana hydroelectric generators originally owned by the Montana Power Company. Montana Power sold them off in the late 1980s as it pursued a speculative dream of becoming a national telecommunications company. Instead, Montana Power went bankrupt and ceased to exist. The hydroelectric generators, of course, are still here in Montana, humming away, producing electricity that is simply sold into the Pacific Northwest energy market by the new owners, Pennsylvania Power and Light's Montana branch. PPL Montana wants to geographically retrench and get out of Montana altogether. So Northwestern Energy, in an effort to rebuild the integrated utility on which Montana relied for almost a century, offered to purchase those hydroelectric facilities and rededicate them to Montana residents. PPL's Montana's initial response was no, you cannot buy just the hydroelectric facilities, but you can buy all of the electric facilities in Montana, including our shares of Colstrip Power Plants 1, 2, and 3. The Corret coal-fired plant in Billings that PPL Montana was planning to shut down next year was also included in the package. Northwestern Energy proceeded to submit a bid for all of PPL Montana's electric generating assets in Montana for $400 million, but then also submitted another bid of $740 million for only the hydroelectric generators. Northwestern ultimately entered into a purchase agreement for just those hydroelectric projects for $900 million. It is that $900 million hydro purchase agreement that the Montana Public Service Commission is currently evaluating. The intriguing question that the Montana Public Service Commission is certainly asking is why Northwestern would offer to pay $740 million for just the hydroelectric generators, but only $400 million for a much larger set of generators that included all of those hydro units. Depending on how you measure the productivity of these electric generators, the total package, including both the coal-fired and hydroelectric generators, was over 800 megawatts of generating capacity, three times as large as the 280 megawatts that the hydro facilities alone can provide. Yet Northwestern Energy offered to pay only about half as much to get generators with almost three times the production capacity as the hydro units have. What gives? Northwestern's explanation is simple and straightforward. The future economic viability of coal-fired electric generation is very uncertain. The courts and EPA have been clamping down on the air emissions associated with older, dirtier coal-fired plants, insisting that very expensive air pollution controls be installed. In addition, with the U.S. Supreme Court's approval, EPA has moved to regulate the emissions of greenhouse gases from coal-fired plants. Finally, EPA has just begun to regulate the toxic sludge produced by coal-fired generators that is stored in ponds that regularly leak and periodically fail catastrophically. All of this makes the economic viability of coal-fired electric generators very uncertain. As a result, investors and electric utilities have largely stopped building coal-fired electric generators. Hard, cold financial calculations indicate that these are not safe investments. That is what Northwestern Energy has told the Montana Public Service Commission. When the costs of cleaning up the pollution associated with PPL Montana's coal-fired facilities are included in the financial analysis, the financial value of those electric generators as a group is negative. That is, they have no economic value. They are a huge economic liability because of the future costs associated with cleaning them up. The Montana hydroelectric facilities, however, carry none of the environmental liabilities of the coal-fired generators. The hydro facilities generate electricity without using any fossil fuels and without releasing any greenhouse gases. Most of them have also recently undergone environmental review by federal energy regulators and have been relicensed for another 50 years of operation. As a result, Northwestern estimated the value of PPL's Montana coal-fired electric generators as a negative $340 million. When combined with Northwestern's estimate that the hydroelectric facilities were worth $740 million by themselves, the offer Northwestern made for the whole package was only $400 million. Of course, those who believe that the future of the Montana economy and the nation's energy independence is tied to coal will find this Northwestern financial analysis outrageous. Of course, many of those coal enthusiasts also do not believe that the combustion of fossil fuels causes global warming. The recognition of that potential greenhouse gas environmental liability associated with coal-fired generation in the financial analyses of many electric utilities and the same conclusions reached by Wall Street financial analysts is incomprehensible to the coal boosters. It is seen as proof that the supposed federal war on coal has gotten out of hand and even infected Wall Street. Alternatively, this hard-nosed financial analysis may help undermine the position of those ideologically based flat-earth enthusiasts who insist we have to abandon science to have a future. The opposite, of course, is true. It is time to face up to the nearly irreversible damage we're doing to our atmosphere and begin making the rational adaptations in our energy use that we can before nature forces us to more costly and disruptive adaptations.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.